Howdy, partners. Welcome back. Early Thursday start this time. We got Ben, we got Matt. Excited for Matt to unleash some IPP stuff on today's call. But how's everyone doing? Ben, how are you?
I'm good. You might hear a dog barking in the background here. I'm actually in Boulder, Colorado at the moment, Tom. Yeah, I should have told you. I'm only now just realizing that I'm up the road from you.
You're like 40 minutes away.
Well, yeah, I advise for a company and they're based here. So I've been here for the last kind of 2-3 days, just hanging out and taking in the sights. And yeah, it's beautiful, beautiful little spot. So cold, but good is probably my summary of it.
Yeah, it's been a little chilly in Colorado. Ben, we can talk afterwards about why you haven't texted me for a meetup because I'm literally 40 minutes down, but that's fine. I love Colorado. Boulder is a fun spot. Matt, nice to meet you. Welcome to the pod.
Thanks so much, Tom. Ben, appreciate you including me on this. While you guys are in really cool spots, I'm actually in New York City. If you couldn't tell behind me, it looks like it's super dark. The typical New York City inner unit apartment. I have no idea if it's sunny. I have no idea if it's raining. It looks like it's raining all the time, but nonetheless, here and ready to make it happen.
You and Matt, you and I share a very, I guess, similar thing about our work environments. Like, I'm in the basement. You can't see it right now, but all I have is a tiny window. So my vitamin D levels have like just plummeted, whether it's sunny or not. Colorado gets like 300 days of sun. So I feel your pain. When I go upstairs, it's like, what am I doing? Like, should I be up here? So anyway, fun little fact there.
Yeah, I need a vitamin D light simulator.
Yeah,
I don't know if you guys can see. It's currently behind me. I don't know why. For some reason, I think that you can use it to keep plants alive.
Oh, for sure.
Well, I was just about to ask you. We usually launch this on Spotify, mate. And so for the people that are just listening in, Matt has a great collection of plants behind him on the screen. And I was just about to ask how those plants grow with no light.
No, they're fake. And I'm still trying to figure out if the vitamin D light is actually going to work, or am I just like thinking it's the placebo effect? Probably the light, but hey, we'll let you know in a couple of weeks.
Probably sure. Better. Yeah, well, anyway, Tom, as you said, we're pumped to have Matt on. Me and Matt worked together previously, so I was really excited to get him on. Matt, would love you just to dive in and give all the listeners a little kind of history or breakdown on you and really your experience in partnerships.
Great. Thanks, Ben. Hey, everyone. My name is Matt Dong. I'm currently the Director of Business Development at Electric. Electric is a IT software and services organizations for small to medium-sized businesses between 5 to 500 employees. Throughout my career, I've spent the bulk of it as an individual contributor, AE, doing sales, selling software and services, whether it's HR, marketing, outdoor advertising, engineering, to a lot of different personas, primarily across the C-suite. So I did that for about 8 to 9 years. And then over the past year, I've spent building the business development go-to-market lane at Electric, which was a way for us to acquire customers at scale for less money. So it was a really exciting initiative that was started by our former CMO, Andrea Kale, who built the function with me and gave me the opportunity to do it. So pumped to be here.
Cool. Yeah, and I think it's very fitting given your background and that introduction around the topic we're gonna kind of jump into today, which is ideal partner profile, covering everything from how do you define it and kind of how do you grow with the ideal partner profile. And so I know you came in to pretty much a nothing program and built and scaled it into something pretty big. And so I think if we start from kind of step one, when you came in and you were looking at, hey, we need to go out and recruit partners, what was your thought process in terms of like a good partner fit for Electric? And how did you build out the ideal partner profile?
The way that we can frame this is really just around my background and ultimately how this ties into business development and partnerships, and then tying it then to how I've come up with the IPP strategy. So just a quick run through, primarily throughout the course of my career, mainly where I was for the first 5 to 6 years at ADP doing small business and mid-market sales, I've experienced the motion of leveraging partners to get referrals to sell deals. And at ADP, their primary go-to-market lanes for partnerships are CPA firms, consultancies, as well as brokerages. In addition to doing that at Intersection, which is an outdoor media company, their primary source of revenue as it relates to partners is advertising marketing agencies. So I've done it before as an individual contributor and felt very comfortable with the motion, leveraging partners to get referrals, selling the referrals, keeping those relationships to get more business. So the way it worked at Electric, when that role opened up, I saw the job description. I was like, shoot, I've done this before. So the way I approached IPP, it was interesting, right? As a person that has sold Electric, over the course of my career, I sold about like 20 plus deals for over about $1.3 million in ARR. So I'm very familiar and comfortable with selling the Electric product and knowing who the buyers are. And what I looked for was primarily services organizations that provided complementary services and software to Electric. So organizations that are consulting CFOs, HR people, providing IT support, all the way down to insurance brokerages and property and casualty brokerages that sold cyber liability insurance. Also stretching as far as private equity and venture capital, just trying to figure out what types of partners will ultimately have conversations around Electric or something related to IT. Alternatively, using that as a way to really expand reach across multiple verticals, because you never know, right? You got to test and see what actually works. So that's what went into V1 as we developed the IPP. I'm happy to go into more details about each type of partner and then the value proposition, because each one was unique.
Two things. One, I'm in the middle of like, we just completely revamped our program at SaaS Labs. And the IPP was one of the big selling points to me actually getting the job. So I think this is very relevant. And there's two things. One, your close relationship to being an AE and being in front of customers, you know, people that are getting into partnerships and discussing what, like why an IPP is important, don't always think about what their existing ICP is and how then like you come back up a layer. Like everyone thinks like, okay, we've got to figure this out for, you know, channel partnerships or tech partnerships. And tech is a little bit harder to really dive into because it's just more broad and speak. But when it comes to someone like channel partners, the ICP helps drive everything. So like developing an IPP from scratch can be difficult. And I don't mind that approach because that's somewhat of what we did here. But your ability to connect the dots between the customers that are going to purchase your software again and again versus the service agencies or the partners that can help lead you there is so important. So one point is like, it's awesome that you have the experience from being in sales, because I think it just lends itself so nicely to say like, I know my ICP. I know how I can sell these customers. Let's bring this back up a level. I know the partners I need to target right away. So that's really cool. I appreciate that sentiment.
Yeah, I mean, you keep it simple, right? Straight up, like what you do is you're just targeting companies that sell to the same customers and same personas, and then figure out what the value proposition is and why they want to refer Electric. So that's ultimately how we created it.
Yeah, that's exactly. I think like, again, this topic tends to get overcomplicated, but what you've just said there is probably the most easy way of describing it. And that's why I think having Andrea involved from a CMO position intimately knows what your ICP is and what customer you're trying to sell into gives you a really good direction, I think, from an ideal partner profile, right?
Absolutely. And just for clarity, the way that it's structured at Electric is a lot different than a lot of organizations. The way that we were built is mainly Andrea owned all go-to-market lanes to drive top funnel. So it was really interesting and a wonderful learning experience and something that was a ton of fun to build.
Cool. Yeah. And I think like anybody that's listening to this, having a singular person really at the C-suite level shepherd everything can be really, really helpful, because Matt, I know Electric does a lot of co-marketing with partners, right? And so having Andrea involved from the top and supportive of that is really helpful in just actually driving go-to-market with your partners later down the line. And so, yeah, I think that's a really important just side note is where possible, really tie into your CMO, intimately understand your ICP and kind of go from there. And so I think more broadly, Matt, you talked about how you defined it at Electric, and we've gone into a little bit of the strategy behind developing an IPP. Anybody that's net new into a program and is looking to do this, what process should they follow?
Yeah, I just think a lot of it comes down to being very specific about who you sell to, the types of customers, and then the personas, again, tying back to your ICP. And then what are the partners that surround those types of organizations? Because ultimately, at the end of the day, you want to build an ecosystem. And once you're able to build an ecosystem around each and every customer, that is going to drive a ton of value, whether it's related to revenue shares, which I think are great, but not the most exciting. I think most companies care about just creating a stickier environment and being seen as a hero or champion to their customers when they're recommending something that's completely outside of their scope. So that's ultimately where I see a lot of value in these types of strategies and approaches outside of just direct customer acquisition strategies.
Yeah, and I'd love to quickly just dive into that final point you made around like it needs to offer value to both sides. And so you mentioned a couple of your profiles that you have at Electric, and you mentioned like the private equity company, right? What is the value for the private equity company of bringing in Electric and kind of pushing you to their customers?
Totally. For private equity, let's give an example using Electric, right? For these firms that do mergers and acquisitions, we want to work with private equity firms that are representing the merger side. And ultimately what they're looking to do across two organizations is integrate systems and create operational excellence across the board. So you could think HR, finance, ops, whatever technology in addition to IT. So those are the core pillars of what you think about a foundational business operation. So when you have that messaging, what makes it easier for private equity firms to digest, once you have to make it easy for private equity firms to digest like the value proposition, ultimately what they're looking for there is the ability to find standardized pricing, best in market pricing that they can go to their portfolio companies with. So all the portfolio companies are responsible for doing is evaluating the solution, seeing if it's a fit, removing the need to negotiate because they know the cost per user per month is within their wheelhouse and expectations are clear up front. So on the business side, you create deal velocity and you create more predictability from a forecasting standpoint. On the private equity side, they can also forecast costs as it relates to different software and services that they need to pay for across the business to ensure that they integrate too, especially during an M&A, for example.
Cool. There's more efficiency, cost savings, all the things that actually they're gonna really care about. Yeah, I love that. Yeah, it's so important. The things that when you're looking to partner, think about the things that make them tick, what they're metriced on, and then try and align your product or service to those things. So let's change gears a little bit. We've kind of gone into ideal partner profile, how to define it, what it means. The second part, it becomes when you've signed those partners, so you've developed an ideal partner profile, you've taken on, and again, all these private equity firms, how do you really kind of dig in or focus efforts on the partners that matter instead of like spreading yourself too thin and trying to be like, you know, white glove for everyone? Like, how do you think through prioritization of partners?
People, process, and then prioritization to build structure as it relates to each individual partner management strategy. So the way I think of these things is capacity models across operating models that we have as a business. So for example, just to give you a little bit of context, I have channel business development reps, a team of three of them. What they're responsible for doing is acquiring partners, walking them through Electric's pitch, like typically doing the SDR stuff, right? Prospecting organizations within our IPP, pitching the Electric partner program, signing them up, and then enabling them to refer, and then going deep and wide and using that as a way to drive results. So when you think of it holistically, the reps will get to a certain inflection point where they have a good number of quality partners. I think 50 to 75 is realistic. Obviously, there's a lot of different variables that go into it, like size, contact, relationships. I mean, you name it. There's no right way to do it, but some things to take into consideration. And then oftentimes, instead of focusing on new partner acquisition, you can just start focusing on different aspects of the operating model. It's like, hey, what is your partner referral rate? You have 50 partners. Can you hit the, for example, 17% referral rate that we're expecting, which is one referral per partner per month? when you go further down, you'll hit a certain inflection point where you don't need to acquire more partners per rep. And then they're responsible for just focusing on two aspects of the operating model that are just lower. It's like number of referral or partners referring. Excuse me. Then the first is number of partners referring across your active partner portfolio. And the second is how many referrals per referring partner. And then from there, the prioritization just comes down to who's the most engaged.
And the one, as you're going through this, like it resonates, it should resonate with every partner professional to some degree, is that, you know, it's not your typical relationship building. And I think in all the good sense, like you need to be very honest and transparent with every partner that you're introducing yourself to. And it's interesting to see that you've got, you know, these channel reps that will carry them through, you know, sign up through activation or enablement. That's amazing. That's actually what we're trying to do here with a couple of channel BDRs to some degree. But then, you know, like as you start to look at the ecosystem, I keep referring back to this post and I can't remember who posted on LinkedIn, but like, if a partnership isn't working, just be like upfront. Like you don't need to triage it. You don't need to have all these like crazy course correction calls. Like just call a spade and be like, listen, you know, if things are slowing down with you guys, that's totally fine. I'm here to help when you're ready, but it's the game of necessity. And so if you've got partners that are actually like dominating the system, like focus there, like capitalize on that gold and really drive the value. Because like, if your number's base, like you've got to be able to cut back, especially when you start to talk about capacity. So I like that point.
Yeah, for sure. I think at the end of the day, like everyone is going to want to partner with you.
Yeah.
And if they're not willing to make things happen, it's kind of just like what you say is a lot different than what you do. If they're not doing the doing, and that's like not showing up in results, deprioritize them, push them out a quarter. You don't need to focus on every partner referring. I think that's unrealistic, especially if you go deep and wide. There's so many different people you can talk to, from a CSM to an AM to an AE to their managers, directors, all the way to partner marketing. You can get super freaking creative, which is awesome about this type of role.
Yeah, I love that. And Matt, one just quick point. So you've got partner BDs kind of underneath you. When would you get involved if like a partner was really producing and maybe add some like executive level touch point to the relationship to maybe, you know, pump it even more? Like when would you say like that's a point for you to kind of get involved in the relationship and maybe take it to the next level?
Early and often. I think every new partner, you have to treat them with the most respect possible, because you never know. Someone might come in and look on paper like, I don't know, this might not be a huge opportunity. But there have been instances where you judge a book by its cover, and then you realize like, oh shoot, this company is referring a ton. And not only are they referring a ton, a lot of them are qualifying. And because they're qualifying and we have a 30% close rate for BD source qualified deals, I mean, those are legitimate and salespeople want that. How do you get more? So that's why you never want to assume that an organization that might not look great on paper is not a great partner, because that's never always the case. I've seen good ones too, like on paper, you're like, oh shoot, they have 1,000+ customers, great contacts. And they're just like, I could give two shits about you guys.
It's so funny. I like just my experience on the HubSpot ecosystem. You know, like you look at every agency that comes from a channel perspective and it's like HubSpot agency. And like, that's great. And it's so funny that you mentioned that, cause I'm like looking on paper at a couple of these partners and like, oh crap, this partner is like completely global, top of the space, and they do nothing, versus, you know, some of those more scrappy partners that I think it lends itself to speaking on the mindset of your partners, like the paradigm shift that needs to happen, where if you see on paper that they're adaptable and they're completely bought in on scaling their business around strategic partnerships, hit that pedal and go for it. Versus the ones that are kind of on the fence, they almost, you know, going back to the idea of seeing you as a vendor versus an actual alliance, like in the partner professional space, you have to have a keen eye for that. And it's really tough to do it up front. And it's really hard to not judge a book by its cover when you start to see, like, you know, you're in this ecosystem. We know these agencies, but you really don't until you get to know them. And I think that mindset understanding lends itself so nicely to be like, you're going to surprise me, like do it right now and show that you're bought in and let's run.
Yeah, I take 10 scrappy partners that are looking to grow and scale fast over 10 reputable brands that have market share, because those ones are typically the hardest to work with.
Yeah, I love it. And I mean, like, it's always the way with people that don't understand partnerships, that are like, hey, we should go after Deloitte and we should go after Accenture and we should go after, like, when in actual fact, that's going to take you like a year, year and a half to actually activate. So I wholeheartedly agree with that point. So we're kind of coming up on time. So we'll end with kind of a final point or question here, Matt. And it's around refinement of ideal partner profiles. So we started off describing the process you take and what makes a good partner profile. How often are you going back, reviewing that, updating it, et cetera? Like what process do you have there?
So my process is that the verticals remain the same. The key characteristics evolve over time. And then vertical list constantly grows because you're having more under opportunistic ones you take into consideration. Here's what I mean by that. I know it sounds super cryptic, right?
No, I love it.
For example, at Electric, the five that we focus on are financial services firms, insurance brokerages, IT consultancies, and HR consultants. And then there's a separate category for opportunistic, but let's not focus on that now. Primarily speaking, initially when we started focusing on financial services organizations, I was just like, yo, let's hit up outsourced CFOs, let's hit up accounting firms, CPA firms, like those would be great. Over time, what we started seeing was that management consulting was pretty interesting. You can even categorize those as financial services. Some may not. Then you think about CPA firms that do SOC 2 audits. That value proposition is drastically different than ones that don't do it, but have business consulting services. So a lot of that has been a part of the evolution of how we think of the key characteristics that go into what we deem as the financial services vertical. And a lot of it comes down to being dynamic when you're looking at the data. Like we're very, very specific in terms of how we track these things under partner accounts and Salesforce. We have different categories built out. So when you look at the data, you're like, oh shoot, we have 180 partners and then 45 of them happen to be financial services and we acquired them over the past 3 months. Like how do we get more of this and how do we build on that database?
I love that. I think you made an important point there, which is, and I was actually writing a note in the background, which is like, and it's just a point to think about. CRM hygiene can be really important there because your point, like categorizing the subcategory of partner around like, and so you can look back at the end of the year and actually say, hey, like management consulting firms, for example, generated the most revenue in our partner program. And so in the following year, my partner BDs go out and capture another 50-100 management consulting firms instead of, you know, PE firms that haven't really generated a ton of revenue for us. So I thought that was a really interesting point because I'm not sure many people do that to be candid.
No, preach. Oh my gosh, CRM hygiene is so important. But I actually really like, Matt, I really like that you brought up the idea that like your verticals, like the verticals should be the same, but the characteristics within each will evolve. And that's critical to think about because, you know, to Ben's question, your IPP is never done. It's never completely set. You always need to be going back. And there's no right or wrong time frame to say like, hey, let's go back and audit this, figure this out. But I do think it's critical to think about that when you're in this ecosystem type play, each ecosystem potentially has those differentiating characteristics. And honestly, like as your product scales and as your product grows, that's a really good time to come back and say, you know, has our pricing model changed? Have we added SOC 2 compliance as a SaaS company? Like those are really important things to think about and how it could alter your approach and who you're trying to target and what your IPP is.
Yeah. Even if you think of the ICP perspective or just like product perspective, that shit changes often.
All the time.
Like we're evolving fast, like primarily from a services business that provides software to fully software. As we make that evolution, that's going to completely impact the types of verticals we focus on our go-to-market messaging. And then it ultimately is just, again, going back to the theme of being dynamic and then also being able to diversify risk by having partners across various lanes and just being able to change the messaging as a whole. Can I make one last point before we leave? That's a little off topic. This goes back to what you were saying, Ben, around CRM hygiene. I think one thing people don't do enough, especially early stage when they're trying to prove something out, is they don't focus on the core aspects of the foundation. That's the number one thing I prioritize: process, structure, technology, tools, operational efficiency from day one. If you don't have that, you're going to build a great program and that shit's going to break down over time because like you just don't have the right tools or systems or processes in place. So be good to your cross-functional leaders, build tight relationships. That's ultimately going to pay dividends over time.
Love it. Great point. Well, with that, Matt, really appreciate you having you on. Tom, great to see you again, and we'll be back next week with another episode.